Hi, my name is Chuck, and I'm an addict. Very enthusiastic this morning. You must not have been the same people who've been chasing your money all over this place. If you are, you must have found it. I had a chance to speak at a meeting in Las Vegas, I guess about 8 or 9 years ago, and it was an activity that they had in the middle of a park. I think probably most of the local fellowship was there, and it would have filled up about 6 or 7 of the tables here, and so it's fantastic what's happened here. This program is wonderful, and I'm very grateful to have been asked to come here and share. I want to start by thanking the committee for asking me to do that. You give me an opportunity to save my life, and I'm very grateful for it. There's some ironic things that happen to you along the road, and one of the most special things happened to me this weekend. I attended a workshop here on Friday afternoon, and I walked out of the workshop, and this young lady said, "Chuck," when I turned around and looked, and she asked me if I'd lived in Glendale, California, and I immediately recognized her. Last time I saw her was about 18 years ago. And we both used seriously in those days. And she was of the variety of addict that was very, very committed to using. And the last person that I ever expected to be alive. And what a special treat to come here and see one of my very dear friends from the past. And where the hell else could you go to get that kind of stuff? You know, this program has literally given me everything. It didn't give me back my life because I didn't have one. I was a member of the Walking Dead when I got here, and you people have literally given me back everything, and really made my life very, very special. Another very, very special thing about this convention, my wife is here, and Lynn and I have been married for almost 12 years. But I'll tell you some stuff about Lynn a little later on. But the interesting thing is, Lynn has never heard me speak. I think she is probably nervous for me. Maybe afraid that I'm going to make an ass out of myself. And what she doesn't know is that I make an ass out of myself all the time. And in spite of that, you people love me. You know, and you people take care of me, and you people heal me in spite of that. So this is a very safe and comfortable place for me. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and I moved pretty soon after I was born, I guess, to Portland, Oregon, and that's where I grew up. And I came from a family that was broken up, and I don't necessarily think that that has anything significant to do with my addiction. I believe it has a whole lot to do with the way I felt about myself growing up, and the way I felt about you people as I grew up, and the way I related with people. In my family, there was always a great feeling of love, and there was a lot of show of love going on. A lot of hugs and kisses and that kind of stuff. But economically, we were really bad off. And so, as a result of that, you know, I spent a lot of time feeling different than the other kids. You know, I can remember graphically, you know, my clothes being bought at the thrift store. You know, a real funny thing about, oh, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was watching something on television, and there were three little kids, and they were playing in the rain, and they were jumping up and down in puddles and whatnot, and they had those yellow raincoats. They had the little metal things that snap, and the little yellow hats on, and I can remember as a kid, boy, I feel so stupid, I can remember as a kid wanting one of those very badly and not being able to have it because we didn't have the money and being very envious and being destructive of other people's property because they had those things and I didn't. The holidays around my house were festive, but they didn't include a lot of toys and goodies. And when there were toys and goodies, they were generally brought there by the Salvation Army or the Knights of Columbus or some group like that. And I can remember as a little child being very selfish and wanting all of those toys and wanting those goodies, but being preoccupied with wanting that truck to hurry up and leave so nobody would see it, so nobody would know. A lot of my childhood was like that. Just feeling less than and feeling different than and compensating for it, you know, by being out of line, you know, just by being out of line. You know, as a child, I compared myself to other people. When I was fairly new in this program, I still had a real problem comparing myself to other people, you know. You know, what you had, what was going on in your life, and how that measured up against me. I can remember as a teenager in junior high school going into the shower. That time in gym class, it was the first time when the boys all showered together, and I even did a lot of comparing in there. And the problem with all of my comparisons is that I have consistently come out on the short end. It became clear to me that I had to quit comparison. Today, I have very distinct memory and knowledge of where I came from, of where I was, of how I was when I walked in the doors, and how I am now, and what my life is like now, and what it feels like inside of here now. And I can tell you it is completely different. Completely different. And I owe it to the program of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm not going to talk a lot about using. I just want to say that I used for as long as I could, you know, and used longer. You know, in the beginning it was a lot of fun. It was exciting. It was a way to belong. You know, Ruben was talking Friday night about the various little cliques of people. You know, the sports people and the intellectuals. And then there was the group of people that did nothing except talk bad about the people that were doing something. And I fit in with that group. And we hung out and got loaded and talked bad about people who were doing something. My using continued, and it got worse. In the end, it was costing me money to feel bad. You know, yeah, that's the divine justice of this disease. Yeah. Today I have the capacity to feel like shit for free. I remember the first meeting that I went to, I had been trying to use, trying to stop using, and was not very successful at it. And I remembered years before having called the local NA hotline, really trying to get a letter to get my brother out of the penitentiary. And I don't know that they sent a letter, but he didn't get out. That's what I remember about it. But I just remember the name Narcotics Anonymous, and I picked up the phone and I called. And at that time, NA was, it was certainly larger in Southern California than in other parts of the world, but it still was pretty unsophisticated. And the guy that answered the phone, it was his house. And I thought, wow, what a tacky organization. I mean, they don't even have like an office or something like that. And because when the guy answered, he said, hello. And I said, I think I got the wrong number. He said, no, you might have the right number. Who are you looking for? And I told him, he said, no, you're okay. And these two guys came up to my place. And at that time, I was living in the basement, like Quasimodo, living in the basement of this house in Tahunga. And, you know, I used to have to pack a lot of blankets and whatnot against the door because it would rain and the water would run down and wake me up. Because it was colder than the wet that was already there. And they came up and we talked, and there was a lot of drama in this, and I threw my outfits out in the street, and I was going to take the cure. And they split, and I went and got my flashlight and went back out there. I said, what in the fuck did you do? You know, I threw away the only thing that kept me alive, that kept me feeling like kind of a human being. So I had to get back out there and find it. And I ended up at this meeting a couple nights later, and it was a candlelight meeting that they had in Van Nuys, California. And I remember asking a question. It was a question and answer meeting. You wrote a little question, you put it in the basket, and they passed it around. And the guy, who later became my sponsor, was chairing the meeting that night, and he picked the question out. And the question that I had asked is there any cure for this? I was looking for a quick answer so I could get back into being a high roller. And he said no. Now, I'm sure he went on to say, but, you know, it can be arrested at some point and recovery is impossible. But I didn't hear that. What I heard was no, and I got up and split. And I continued to use. Finally, a miracle happened. And I had attended a couple of meetings, and I had been, had been with a few members of NA. And one of these men told me that if I used again, my using would never be the same. And if I was lucky, what would happen is that it would actually quit working. And that would make me real miserable. And I couldn't equate how that was going to be lucky. But I listened and was polite and whatnot about it. And I remember sitting on the kitchen floor of this terrible, terrible dive apartment I was living in, called the Brendo Arms. And that's got a sticky feeling to it. You know, it had a bed come out of the wall and cockroaches that were aggressive. And I was using, and nothing was happening, and it was terrifying. I was using, and nothing was happening, and I had just run the last scam that was left to run. You know, I remember hearing people in NA talk about how, you know, they'd be out and they'd be doing this and doing that to get their drugs. And then when they'd really be a real scumbag, you know, they'd rip off people close to them. I was a scumbag from the very beginning. because I lacked courage. And people that were close to me were more vulnerable and were easier. And that's why I abused them and abused their trust. And by the way, these things didn't just all of a sudden happen overnight, the understanding and the revelation about these things. They happened as a result of working the steps and writing inventories and sorting out. some of those things. That's where I came to realize that in my active addiction, I was not courageous at all. I was very cowardly, and I abused people, and I took advantage of people. And that's the way, and there was nothing really glorious about my using. I never had the big bag. You hear people talk about having the bag. I had little teeny, teeny, weeny ones. And I went sick a whole lot, you know. Yeah, that's the way it was. I was very fortunate. I got arrested and invited to become a member of this program or go to the penitentiary. And I gauged up my size and decided that I had no business going to the penitentiary. So I decided I would take a chance on this program. And at that time I wasn't in a recovery house. I was trying to do it from the streets. And it was very difficult. I couldn't stay clean. You know, in the first step it talks about, you know, using to, or in our literature, using to live and living to use. And that's the way it was. That wasn't about choice. You know, there were many, many times that I didn't want to, and I would end up doing it anyway. You know, and I'd make a promise and a commitment to myself, and I'd be back in the spoon anyway. It wasn't about choice. The judge was trying to help me, so he had me on a testing order. And the first thing that I found out from some people who were not real committed to recovery was that I could probably beat this test if I drank some vinegar. And so I drank a 12-ounce glass of vinegar. It was horrible. And I went in and I tested, and it came back clean. And I thought, well, shit, you know, I can do just about anything, you know, for a little while. And so I drank a 12-ounce glass of vinegar every day for about 2 months. To this day, I finally reached a point where I could no longer tolerate it. To this day, I cannot be in the same room with vinegar. So I had to find an alternative to this. And quick, because my PO still wanted me to test. So I had this brainstorm that maybe if I built this contraption to help me test clean, that I could continue, you know, that I could continue this. Because I was terrified to stop. You know, the only time I didn't use, I was miserable. I was a very unhappy person when I wasn't loaded. And I was unhappy when I was, but I was more so when I wasn't. So it was important for me to try to beat this test. So I designed this testing device. It included a plastic bag with the little neighbor boy's clean urine in it, and a plastic tube that went down from the bag. Down, and I had it taped ever so carefully. And I went into the probation department, and I was feeling very confident because I had practiced with this machine, and it worked just fine. And so I went there and got in front of the urinal and gave the bag a little tweak, and nothing happened. And I didn't really, you know, I didn't understand. I gave it another tweak and nothing happened. And my PO was getting nervous because it was taking longer than it should have. And so I figured, well, maybe I better squeeze this thing, you know, a little harder, which I did, and then everything happened. I had urine running down in front of me, and he said, hold it right there. And he ran in to get his partners to bring them in and show them me. And he shook his head and he said, Chuck Lehman, you can't make it. And he was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. And so I ended up getting sent to this recovery house. I'm very grateful to this recovery house because, like Reuben's experience on Friday night, that is where I found Foundation and the program in Narcotics Anonymous. And while I was there, I was a real meathead. And they knew that I was a meathead because I had been there before being a meathead. And this time I had to kick cold. And I was a big baby. I was used to going to detox. And I had to kick cold. And the guy used to threaten. He would tattle on me to my PO, and I'd go to the penitentiary, and that encouraged me to stay. I remember I was laying in the bed feeling miserable, and he came in and he said, "You get your ass out of bed and you go get on the business end of that lawnmower and push it back and forth across about a half an acre." And that's what I had to do every day. And I remember not being happy about it, but it kept me occupied. And it kept me busy. And there were a lot of people who were very significant in my life. There were people who encouraged me to stay and to hang in there. My first meeting back was November 22nd, 1974, and it was at a meeting, and there was a guy from Southern California who had a lot of time clean. In fact, he's dead now, and he died with, I think, pretty close to 20 years clean. I think at the time he had about 17 years clean, and he was very intolerant and impatient with newcomers, particularly those who had gone out and used. And he was talking about, and ridiculing and berating these people who throw this precious gift away when it's been given to them. And he said, "Like that worthless piece of flesh back there." And he pointed back at me. And everybody in the room turned around. They went, "Har, har, 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 har." And I was humiliated. And I will tell you, humiliation may not be the most desirable way, but it's the quickest way to humility. You know, I felt really bad. And I remember he said I was a worthless piece of flesh that wasn't going to make it anyway. And you've heard people talk about sticking around behind a little bit of a resentment. And I can remember, you know, Jack Whaley's wagging tongue at me about not going to make it anyway. And that kept me in my chair until there was something to replace that to keep me in my chair. It has been my experience that you get exactly what you need around here. Nothing more, nothing less. God, as I understand him, has never, ever given me anything I couldn't deal with and I couldn't handle. And he has put people in my life at exactly the right time to give me exactly what I needed. Now, I'll tell you, I have never been one that was real tough with new people and stepped on their neck and jacked them around. And I've always kind of, you know, felt bad when I saw somebody who was new really get themselves nailed against the wall by somebody. But I've kind of changed my opinion over the last maybe year or so about that. November 22nd, 1974, when Jack Whaley stuck his foot in my ass, there were a lot of people in the room who came up to me afterwards and patted me on the back and said, "Oh man, you got such a raw deal from Jack, you know, keep coming back, we love you, etc., etc." That was very important, I'm sure. But I can tell you, I don't remember a single person's face or name. I don't remember anybody who was gentle and kind with me that night. But I do remember Jack Whaley's foot. You know, you do get what you need around here. And that's apparently what I needed then. You know, I've gotten other things around here. I've gotten spiritual awakenings and I've gotten rude awakenings. And they are available in plentiful supply, both of them. And it seems as though when I've needed a rude awakening, that's what I've gotten. And when I'm near the spiritual awakening, that's what I've gotten. And even some of the rude awakenings have ultimately become spiritual awakenings. Where was I going with this? I think Barbara was talking last night about how her sponsor had told her, you know, to shut up in so many words. And I can remember when I was new that there was a fairly strong feeling around here that if you were new, you were supposed to sit down and shut up and listen. And I haven't heard that phrase used a whole lot. You know, in our literature, it talks about the newcomer is the most important person at any meeting. But then it goes on to explain why. And the reason why the newcomer is the most important person at any meeting is so that we can keep what we have by giving it away. And that suggests to me that the newcomer needs to sit down, shut up, listen, and receive. And people who are not new need to be ready to give what was given to them. When I was back after my experience with Jack, I found a sponsor. And this man was very, very special. He was very stern, which was also what I needed. And he was, he made it his job to teach me how to work the steps. And if there is nothing else that I have gotten in this program, and I've gotten many, many things, the one thing that I got was a very, very good foundation in the steps. I was taught exactly how to work them. If you have not been fortunate enough to have somebody sit down and teach you exactly how to work the steps, for God's sakes, go out and find that individual and have them teach you how to work the steps. Because the reality is, if you don't understand the steps, and if you're not working the steps, when the bell tolls, shame on you. You know, this disease doesn't care about commitment, and gee, I want to, and gosh, I can't because I'm going to lose my house, my car, my home, my kids, my dog. It doesn't give a shit about that. You know, it will creep on you and down your shit. And, you know, it is but for the grace of God that we're here, and as a result of the steps, we're able to stay here and to be comfortable. At least that's what it's been for me. I remember we had to clarify some things from the very beginning. I used to run around aggravated because I had to get powerless over a lot of things. And my sponsor kind of took me by the ear and pointed out to me that the first step doesn't say anything about getting powerless. It says we admitted that we were. That's completely different. He says, you don't have to get anything. You already are and have been for a long time. He says, you only have to acknowledge that which is, which has been for a long time. You don't have to get anything. So that helped me out. I didn't like it, but it helped me out. And my concept of a God in the beginning was the power that seemed to work in these rooms. I didn't understand it. It didn't remind me of what I learned in Catholic school. The God that I came in here with was a real sneaky, crafty guy who like kept a notebook and laid in the cut. You know, and kept track, and when you crossed the line, you were history. And so I was fairly certain that I had crossed the line, and so I had to find a different understanding of a power greater than myself. And there's been many, many powers greater than myself. The one that I came to understand first was the one that works in this room, that seems to take away the need for us to use. And that was the first God that I was able to come to any kind of understanding. And I wrote an inventory. And in my inventory, I wrote a lot of sensational things down. Some of them were actually true. I also mixed in an occasional truth that I wasn't very proud of. You know, mean, ornery, vindictive things that I had done to people. And I remember when I was sharing the fifth step with my sponsor, when there was an escapade where I could appear particularly heroic, or together, it was easy for me to expound about those things in detail. When it came to the things that were a little that I was a little less proud of, the things that damaged my character, the things that made my skin not fit, my voice would drop down real low. And he would say, "What? What? Speak up. I can't hear you." And I'd have to say it out loud. Not because I needed to hear it myself. I mean, not because he needed to hear it, because I needed to hear it so that I could acknowledge it, so that I could work through it and get past it and leave it behind. You know, in this program is so interesting because no matter how long you are around here, you always have an opportunity to be a student. You know, I've kind of formulated this opinion in recent times that what we really have here is a big, gigantic classroom. And within the classroom, we have desks, and we have tall stools with pointed hats on them, waiting for us to go there. And occasionally, when we get the lesson right, we also have a lectern to go up and teach. And we move throughout, from the desk, you know, to the dunce chair, to the lectern. And I never have been invited to come up to the lectern, what that it wasn't because I had specific experience, strength, and hope to share with another addict who was coming through the exact same thing. We are not different, you and I. The experiences that I have had, I have listened to enough inventories to know that we feel the same thing, we experience the same thing. We have doubts and fears about the same exact things. And the things that work for you are the things that work for me. And that's the great thing we have that unfortunately a lot of folks don't have. I didn't stay clean from November 22nd of 1974. I used again on June the 5th of 1975. And I remember that day because I was hanging out with a couple of my old partners. You know, the ones that you want to take the cure to. And they weren't looking for the cure. I don't know that they had the disease. You know, maybe that's what attracted me to them. They seemed to be able to do it, you know, and not pick up the tab I had to pick up for it. And so I proceeded to sit around with them, and we were talking, whatever we were talking, probably lies to one another. And, you know, the weed was traveling around the room. And I remember rejecting it two or three times. And then finally, he came around, and I took it, and I smoked it. At the very moment that I took a hit, a little voice inside here said, "Chuck Lehman, you fucked up again." And I felt immediately worthless. Once again, I had compromised my principles. Once again, I had done it to myself. And I thought, well, I'm in this recovery house, and I'm due to graduate very soon. So I can't possibly tell these people. So I'll keep it a secret until I graduate, and then I'll get honest. And I went back to the facility, and I felt terrible. You know, I felt like there was loaded written all over my face, and that everybody knew. You know, I remember, like, ducking in and not wanting to make eye contact with anybody. And 2 weeks later, they offered me a job. You know, I'm going to be Father Flanagan. I'm going to save the addicts. I can't possibly tell them now. And look at all the faith they have in me. They obviously recognize something in me that I don't recognize in myself. So I'll tell them later. And the days went into weeks, and the weeks went into months, and the months went into years. A long, long time. I didn't say anything to anybody for 4 years. The first cake that I took around here was a 5-year cake. And it's interesting when your life is built on a lie, what happens. One of the things that happens, since I'm sure your God works like my God, is he makes sure that you are frequently in places where people are talking about how much time they have claimed. It seemed to me like, it seemed to be like every damn day, you know. God, it was horrible. And the people, you know, they'd be saying, well, yeah, they got this one. And they'd say, well, Chuck, how much time do you have claimed? And I'd say, oh, well, you know, around time. Never specific. You're never telling them. And I finally reached a point where I just couldn't tolerate it anymore. It got real scary and real serious. I was driving to a Southern California convention on Friday night, and I went there, and I walked in the room, and here was a room full of people who knew me. At least they knew me as much as they knew the lie that I was projecting. They loved me. And yet, I felt like I was in a foreign country, in a foreign land, with people whose language I couldn't understand and whose language I couldn't speak. And I couldn't live out there, and I couldn't live in here. I couldn't be comfortable in the chair. The idea of using was gone because it hadn't worked the last time. You know, the last time all it did was make me feel miserable, depressed, self-loathing, and loaded. And I didn't want to go through that again. So I thought, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll just drive my car into a cement thing along the freeway. It was very interesting when Reuben was talking on Friday. There are no new stories. Shooting is messy. And it might hurt. And I'm a chicken. And overdosing would be like getting loaded again. I couldn't do that. You know, people would not get in touch with the fact that I was dead. They would say, oh, yeah, he got loaded again. So I said, well, this is what I'm going to do. And it's funny. At this time, I had a beautiful wife at home who I loved and who loved me, and I had not told her about this. My wife is not a member of the program, and that's been very interesting, I think, for her, and probably for me, too. I'll talk about that, hopefully, later. I'm driving along, and as I'm approaching these things, I'm really planning. You know, the next one I'm gonna buy it, and my hands even were at the point where they jerked on the damn steering wheel. All of a sudden, this voice, and it wasn't like one that happened out here that I was looking around to see what the fuck had gotten in the car with me. It was like something that was happening inside here. And the voice said, Chuck Lehman, no matter what you did, you don't deserve to die for it. And I thought, hey, yeah, wow, that's right. I don't deserve to die for it. But I knew that I was going to have to do some things that were very frightening. On a couple of occasions during the 4 years when I had reached, you know, maximum pain tolerance level, I had gone to a meeting fully prepared to talk about it, and I would raise my hand, and somebody in the audience would raise their hand too, and the leader would call them up, and they'd get up and say, "Yeah, I want to tell you about a real low-life scumbag who's been lying about his clean time. Wow, what a maggot." And then he'd go sit down. And then the leader would say, "Chuck, did you have something to say?" I said, no, I didn't have anything to say. So this time I decided that I was going to give this a shot. I went and I talked to my sponsor, and he said, "Well, you know what you need to do." I said, "Yeah." I went and I talked to my wife, who really didn't understand. One day, 5 days, 5 years, she didn't really understand it, but she supported my need to do that, even though it clearly meant that I could have lost my job and a lot of other things, and I'm very grateful to her for that also. I went to the meeting that night, and I raised my hand and I talked about it. And I really don't know what I was expecting all along. I guess I was expecting you people to say, "Oh, man, you scumbag, get out of here." But that isn't what you guys did. You know, that night, apparently, I didn't need the foot. You know, I mean, for God's sakes, I'd been giving myself the foot for 4 years on a daily basis. I guess that night I needed the hugs, and that's what I got. A lot of hugs and encouragement. And right then, and every day since then, that chair has belonged to me. You know, that has been my chair. This has been my program. You know, I no longer felt like somebody out there that didn't belong. Later on that night, I got home, and there was a message for me to call a friend. And I'm self-centered enough to believe that naturally he was calling to pat me on the head, since everybody else had, and he wanted to get in on the act. And he said, he'd been at the meeting, and he said, "You know, Chuck, I've been living the same lie for a couple of years. And there's been more than one occasion that I've had a gun in my mouth. And I don't need to do that now." And you see, it don't have nothing to do necessarily with me. Thank God I was able to be an instrument or something. My God is very, very, very economical. And if he can take care of two miracles at the same time, he will do it. That man is still clean. And there's an awful lot of those kinds of things that happen around here. You've heard people refer to coincidences of the small miracles in which God chooses to remain anonymous. This program is full of those. You know, people showing up at just the right moment with just the right thing to say. Ironic how that has happened. You know, where I've just been ready to go absolutely out of my mind, where I have sat down and talked with guys that I sponsor, and I've said things to them that I didn't know why the hell I said them. You know, one guy, I told him, I said, "It doesn't matter what you did, you don't deserve to die for it." Not know why I said that, but I found out later why I said that. Because he needed to do the same kind of thing that I needed to do. Awful lot of those things have happened in my life. When I met my wife, she was somebody else's wife. I I remember the first time I saw her. I didn't know she was somebody else's wife the first time I saw her. The first time I saw her, I told somebody that I'm going to marry her. Just like that, I'm going to marry her. I hadn't thought about, hell, I was barely out of diapers, let alone planning to marry somebody. You know, the fact of the matter is her relationship at that time was really over with her husband. But I don't necessarily believe, knowing how I am with my character defects, certainly how I was at that time, and understanding what I do about obsession and compulsion, you know, I wanted what she had to offer. And I'm very grateful that has worked out. You know, we will be celebrating 12 years having been married in September. And she has been just a very special, special blessing in my life, because things that just seem to come natural to her, things like when a situation happens, not looking to figure out how she can take advantage of it, you know, it comes very natural for her to think properly. I have to work very hard at not wanting to take advantage of the situation. You know, I have to apply certain principles to my behavior. It seemed to come very natural for her. She's been a teacher in my life. And we have a beautiful little girl who's 10 years old. And Jennifer is not to be believed. She, when she was born, you know, all mommies can look at babies and see how beautiful they are. And I don't know if daddies can't do that or not, but I looked at her and she looked like my father. And you know how there's people in the world, men and women, who are just physically very, very beautiful. Very beautiful girls, very handsome, good-looking men. And it seems like things just come easy. And then there's those of us who are a bit plain. And we have to work a little harder. And I was looking at Jennifer, and I said, well, honey, your grandpa does have good eyes. And you know, it's ironic. She is absolutely gorgeous. You know, she looks exactly like her mother. Thank God. I was scared to death she was going to get my legs. Short and big around. And she hasn't. And my relationship with that little girl has been real special. She says that she has her mommy's outside and her daddy's inside. And she does. She's got a real sense of humor and is very playful, I guess, kind of like I am. See, I almost missed that. See, that's the thing that... talk about gratitude. I am so grateful to this program. You know, I almost missed that. Recovery in Narcotics Anonymous has not always been a real bowl of cherries. You know, life on its own terms is not always fair. It is always real. The difference between today and when I got here is today I am a little better prepared to deal with life on its own terms, thanks to you people, and God as I understand Him in the 12 steps, than I was before. In 1980, my brother died. And he died from this disease. And caused me a lot of pain. Patrick and I had kind of a special relationship. We used together, and he always kind of treated me like his snot-nosed little brother, probably because I was his snot-nosed little brother. And Patrick never really, he was quite a bit older than me, and he never really treated me with much respect. I always wanted it from him. He was quite a bit older than me, and I kind of looked at him sort of like a hip father figure. I always wanted that respect from him. I never could get it. And after I was clean a while, my opportunity to try to help Patrick get clean came. He'd gotten himself in trouble and was in the San Diego County Jail. And I went absolutely crazy trying to dope fiend the judge and the system and everything else to try to get Patrick into this recovery house and ultimately get him introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. And I went to visit him. I said, okay, this is what you got to do, et cetera, et cetera. And he couldn't do that. He showed up to court, loaded, and began to debate jurisprudence with the judge. And that was the end of Patrick's opportunity to get into the recovery house. And when I went to visit him in the county jail, I talked to him and I said, you know, Patrick, I understand. It was all set. You know, all you needed to do was show up. And he said, well, you know how I am, and I understand about obsession and compulsion and addiction. I understand about not having choices. He told me, he says, you know, he said, the reality is that if you got me in that recovery house and I decided I wanted to use, I'd use. And I said, I understand that. I said, if that happened, you know, we'd just throw your shit in the street. And he said, yeah, that probably is what would happen, but in the process, you'd end up looking bad. And I want that to happen to you. And even though that sounds like kind of a, you know, a dope fiend cop-out, my brother never cared whether I looked bad at all, ever. And I was not to know at that time how very special that moment was, because that's the last time I saw Patrick. 2 weeks later, he got out of the county jail, and a week after that, he overdosed and died. If there is a blessing in that, it is that my relationship with Patrick was closed on a very positive note. You know, it was closed on a very positive note. And not only that, I didn't have to go through that thing alone. You people were there. You were there with me. You know, my reality and my ability to handle crisis prior to being clean was nil. I couldn't do that. You know, any kind of crisis was a good day to go get loaded. You know, not that I needed a good day to go get loaded, but that just made it a little better day. And you people were there. You encouraged me. You held my hand when I carried him and when I buried him. You helped to nurse me back to health from that. You know, most recently an experience, character defects, maybe in the last year and a half or so, I learned something startling about character defects. I had for a long time prayed to gain strength to deal with my various character defects. I can remember asking God, oh, give me the strength to deal with this. Give me the strength to deal with that. If you're a weightlifter and you want to build up strength, you put more weight on the bar. And if you're a God who has been asked to give you strength to deal with a character defect, you inspire that character defect more and more so that you can get stronger and stronger. The step doesn't say anything about getting strength to deal with character defects. It says humbly ask him to remove them. And that suggests once again that we're powerless over them. That's one of the things that is magical about Narcotics Anonymous, is that I am always a student, and there's always a teacher, and I can find these things out. And the whole thing with character defect comes into play right now in my life. When my, I guess about 5 years ago, my 14-year-old niece came to live with me, and initially she was going to come for the summer. She was having some problems at home, and she came to live with me, and I had the pleasure of raising a teenager. I guess it's kind of a trial run for what's happening with Jennifer. God, I hope not. Recently, my niece moved out and, you know, joined the workforce and all that kind of stuff. And recently she returned pregnant and with a meathead of a boyfriend. Yeah. I can remember her coming home from high school and bringing these characters, you know, to meet me. That was a rule that we had, you know, that I had to meet all the wonderful guys in her life. And this, I don't know, maybe my wife and I look or act like Mr. and Mrs. Tim Leary or something. But these people take the strangest liberties. This one guy that comes home, sees me working with something, and I had a broken window in my car. And I think, you know, maybe to impress me, he told me how he had kicked the windshield out of his parents' car because they wouldn't let him borrow it. And I explained to him that his train was leaving right now. And that I could hear it in the distance, and he'd better run for it. This current guy that she has, he's a very aggravating soul. I'm sure he's there to teach me some lessons. We had this meeting at the house, and I had a fire going in the fireplace, and I was over there with the poker, you know, kind of arranging the wood. And the more he would talk, the more aggravated I got. And I was thinking for a moment. I was wondering if the fireplace was big enough to burn him up. And, you know, recently, we have a cat who has recently had kittens. And I thought, well, maybe if there's anything left over that won't burn, maybe they're hungry enough to eat it. Ultimately, God, as I understand him, intervened. I was playing it out. Well, this would be a mess. How can I do this? How can I convince these other people in the house that this is really the right thing to do? And I thought, well, I probably can't. The bottom line is, she has moved back out, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do, and I'm going to have to admit that I am powerless. I'm not going to have to get powerless, as I already am, and have been for a long time. You know, I'm just going to have to admit it. It gives me kind of a bird's eye view of what my mom must have been going through. You know, it really does. It's amazing. You know, I've made a lot of mistakes since getting clean. And my judgment has not always been good. I have tried to practice the principles. Generally speaking, my best efforts are after I am in agony, and I just can't stand living with me or living with the situation anymore. And if you're new and that doesn't inspire you, that's okay. Maybe you'll have an opportunity to have somebody in the house who you want to put in the fireplace. Yeah. I guess the plus is that he didn't end up in the fireplace. If you are new, don't you take nothing. Don't you use no matter what. You know, it doesn't matter what goes wrong. If you lose an old lady, you get an old lady. You lose a job, you get a job. Your dog dies. Nothing. Don't you take nothing. I don't care if your ass drops off, you don't take nothing. Because it will not put your ass back on. It will only make you feel worse about it being gone. Because not only will your ass be gone, but so will your recovery be gone. You know, this program has given me everything. When I got here, I had a very strange attitude. I had a very small paper sack that contained all of my belongings. I had a relationship with my mother that had deteriorated to the point where she packed up and moved and wouldn't let me know where she went. That's another thing. An awful lot of us, you know, have things that have happened to them in their childhood. You know, they've had things go on. And I'm running out of time, and I don't want to stretch this thing out. But I did want to say this, that as I wrote my first inventory, there were a lot of things in it that I was unprepared to see, and that is why it wasn't revealed. That is why I have had to continue to take inventories. I have had to continue to write fourth steps. There are people who believe that you can do at one time, and if you get it right, then you don't have to do it again. You just keep everything right with 10, 11, and 12. That has not been my experience because I had so much stuff going on when I got here from my past that I was unprepared to deal with, I was unprepared to look at. So when the time was right, God revealed it. And always, at the same time as it was revealed, the tools with which to deal with it were also provided. This man was speaking at a convention, and he talked about losing an eye as a child and about how he went and he talked to his mother about it. And she told him, she said, well, it serves you right for playing with Johnny so-and-so. And he remembered at the time that that was not what he expected to hear. And he was very bitter and very angry for many years. And then as a result of looking at that, he came to understand that his mother was doing absolutely the very best she could do. She had no intention of saying anything that was going to cause him problems. And when he shared that story, I was sitting there in the room and I started to cry. I didn't really know why. I went back and I talked to my sponsor, and it was time for me to get back with the pen and the paper. When I was a kid, we were bad off financially, as I indicated before. And I had to go into foster home. And while I was in the foster home, I got slapped around a lot, and I got molested by the foster parent's teenage son. And I remember coming home and telling my mom what had happened. And the problem was that I had to keep going back there to get it some more. And that produced that same sense of confusion and of anger and of hostility that took a few years in the program to come to understand. First, it had to be revealed, and it was revealed by one of you people carrying the message. And it had to be written. I had to look at it. I had to come to understand that Mom was doing the very best she could do. We are not different, you and I. There are so many of us in here right now who are dragging around bags of shit that we don't need to. I know an awful lot of women in the program of Narcotics Anonymous who have stories of incest that just tie them up and keep them tied up for years and years. And men that have got terrible, terrible stories of things that have happened to them in their childhood and in their young adulthood. You know, things that just have caused them terrible, terrible grief and pain. And the reality is we don't need to drag that stuff around. We don't need to keep it. We have a place to get rid of it. We have a loving God who will hold our hands and take us through everything. And I know that to be a fact because that has been my experience. If the people who harmed you did so because they didn't know any better, they were doing the best they could do, then we got to deal with that, and that's the way it was. And if they did it because they were sick and mean, then we got to deal with it because that's the way it was. We have to accept it, and then we have to move on. So we got to get that shit out of the bag because God has so many blessings in store for us. He has given me so much, and I have no reason to believe that He will not do the same for everybody else in this program. I have stood and I have watched. And I have watched the people come in, and I've watched their lives completely restored. You know, and everything about them put back the way it should have been. And I'll tell you what, whatever you do, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Thank you, and God bless you.